Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today, Dr. Gabor Mate talks about addiction. Addiction is biochemical, but hard drugs don't cause addiction, he says. A hard, stressful social and economic environment affects the brain, and that causes addiction. Should we crack down on capitalism instead of cocaine? I hope you'll stay tuned. In mid-February, New World Notes marked its fourth anniversary. That's not much compared with some veteran weekly shows like Alternative Radio and Unwelcome Guests. But it's enough that I can look back at our archives and be struck by the many important subjects we haven't talked much about. And by the several important subjects we haven't talked at all about. One of these is the war on drugs, or as many say, the so-called war on drugs. Like all wars, this one is justified by several noble proclaimed goals. In this case, protecting both the individual and society from the harmful effects of drug addiction. And like all wars, the real goals here seem to be very different from the noble pretend goals that the rulers proclaim in order to persuade the people to go along with the plan. By everybody's account, the war on drugs has been a colossal, ignominious failure. And indeed it has been, for the better part of a century, and a very expensive failure. A failure, that is, if you take the professed goals at face value. Silly citizen, there's your error right there. I think the real goals are a lot more sinister than the noble professed goals. But I'm getting ahead of myself again. Dr. Gabor Mate is a Canadian physician. For several years, he has been working with what you might call hardcore down-and-out drug addicts, especially heroin addicts, in the city of Vancouver's equivalent of Skid Row. He's written a book on addiction, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Here are some of his conclusions. Drug addiction is real. Addiction is caused not by the drug, but by circuits of the brain. These brain circuits are greatly affected by the environment, especially the immediate economic, political, and social environment. The environment in the capitalist West today produces great insecurity and stress among the majority of the people. These stresses themselves have many bad medical consequences, including increased incidences of cancer, heart disease, depression, and asthma, and increased propensity to become physiologically, biochemically addicted to certain chemical substances that some other people can take without becoming addicted. The drugs have the effect of triggering hormones that reduce the feeling of stress. A lot of recordings of Mate are floating around. About the best I've found is a recent interview with Mike McCormick, host of the radio series Mind Over Matters, out in Seattle. We'll hear some parts of that. We'll follow that with part of a talk Mate gave in Berkeley. Here in the interview, Mate discusses contributing factors to addiction.
When you actually look at it, you're struck by two things. One is that it's very much a condition of the brain. And you can show on brain scans and other brain studies which circuits are involved. And the more you recognize the brain function and how an automatic it is, the less you think that there's actually much of a choice in the matter. That's the first point. The second point is, if you look at what shapes those brain circuits, it's now known that the human brain develops not according to some random or strictly defined genetic program, but in fact in interaction with the environment. And if you look at the hardcore drug addicts who are the, again, at the extreme end of the scale that I work with in the downtown east side, invariably they were severely abused children. The women were all sexually abused, many of the men were, and they all suffered neglect and deprivation in the emotional sense and often in the physical sense as well. Significant percentage are First Nations peoples, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, who are really at the, again, the bottom of the social pyramid, politically, economically, and socially. And these early experiences actually shape the brain in certain ways that make addiction, if not totally inevitable, highly likely. And the same thing has been shown in large-scale American studies, so that in large population studies, they've shown that the most significant influence on injection drug use in adulthood is the depth and duration of adverse experiences in childhood.
In addition to being raised in an abusive family setting or lack thereof, then what other factors go into that? For instance, is stress a contributor to this?
Stress both early in life, already during pregnancy. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, their kids will be more likely to crave alcohol as adults. This has been shown in animal studies. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, as for example a study showed during 9/11, their children will have abnormal stress hormone levels at 1 year of age. And addiction is very often a question of stress regulation. In other words, people drink or they use drugs or they engage in addictive behaviors like eating or shopping or gambling when they're stressed. So if the early stress regulation parts of the brain don't develop properly because the parents were so stressed, not necessarily abusive, but just highly stressed, that would predispose the child towards addiction later on. And then, of course, the research shows that the biggest driver, the biggest trigger for addictive relapse is stress. So that during an economic crisis like right now, predictably, a lot more people are eating junk food or people are eating more junk food because junk foods release the same chemicals in the brain that the drug addict is after, which is to say the endorphins, which is the brain's natural opiates, and dopamine, which is the brain's natural incentive, motivation, and vitality chemical. These substances are released through addictive behaviors and by the addictive drugs as well. So when people are stressed, they'll do something addictive because at that moment that'll give them some stress relief and some soothing and some of those feel-good chemicals that make them feel more balanced and less troubled momentarily. But of course, with more craving that crops up almost right away. Again, in some families, postpartum depression on the part of the mother is a predisposition towards problems later on in life. And not because these mothers are bad mothers or abusive mothers or anything but loving mothers, but because when the parents are depressed, they can't have that quality of emotional connection with the child. Much as they love the child, they can't be as attuned to the child as they would like to be. And it was here in Seattle, at the University of Washington, that some years ago that an electrical encephalogram study was done of infants at 6 months of age. That's an EEG, which is an electrical readout of the neurological activity of the brain. And they compared the EEGs of six-month-old infants whose mothers were depressed to infants whose mothers were not depressed. And they could tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. In other words, the child's brain is programmed by the emotional states and the quality of the emotional interaction with the parent. And this has been shown in all kinds of animal studies and human experience and so on. And so that means that what happens to us early in life is a decisive influence in shaping how we might go later on. It's not the only influence, but it's an important one. It's a crucial one. And so that's another risk factor. And then there's one more factor in our society, which I talk about in our book, Hold On To Your Kids, which is that human beings were never meant to be brought up in nuclear families. We always grew up in clans, tribes, villages, neighborhoods, communities, extended families. As the African saying goes, that Hillary Clinton was fond of quoting, it takes a village to raise a child. So in the natural habitat for human beings, children are raised by a whole network of nurturing adults. Now, that's totally broken down in our society. Not only don't we have the clan, tribe, community, village, neighborhood, we don't have the extended family anymore because of economic dislocation and all kinds of stress. And the nuclear family is under such stress that both parents have to work very often to make a living. And so kids will grow up around other kids in daycares, and so that the primary connection for children very often becomes no longer the nurturing adults, but other children. And another factor that really drives addictive behaviors is the peer influence. But the peer influence is not a natural one. It's a completely unnatural consequence of social disintegration. So there are many cultural and social and economic influences that are driving addiction, but they all come down to what environment children grow up in.
But wouldn't peer influence be there in a healthy village?
No, in a healthy village, when you walk down to a village in Africa, if you're an adult, kids you've never seen before in your life will call you uncle or aunt. They relate to you like an adult, because that's how they used to relate to nurturing adults. So they're not just looking to other kids for modeling and how to be in values and how to behave. They're looking to adults. And initiation in traditional cultures happens from elders, not from peers. What happens when you get initiation from peers is you get the teenage gangs. When you get initiation from adults, you get introduced into the adult culture. And so that there's tradition and security behind that. Whereas in a gang, you have nothing but insecurity. And so that's another major risk factor in North America. And if you look at the kids who are most at risk, they happen to be the minority kids in the United States whose family life have been totally disrupted by hundreds of years of history. Very often the fathers aren't around, and these kids get into gangs very early. And they're the ones who are in jail because of marijuana and cocaine problems. And so we end up punishing people for the fact that they didn't have the right conditions when their lives began.
Sticking with talking about the influence of mothers when they're carrying the babies, we would often hear things that, for instance, smoking while you're pregnant is bad.
Yeah.
Do you think the bigger contributor there is the tobacco or the situation that is causing stress that turns one towards using the tobacco?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because tobacco, of course, is a stimulant. So tobacco releases nicotine as a stimulant, like caffeine is, like cocaine is, and like crystal meth is. So the tobacco smoker is after the same brain chemical that the cocaine injector is after. It gives a momentary calm and wakes them up and all that kind of thing. Now, first of all, a significant percentage of smokers have ADHD, because how we treat ADD is with stimulants like Ritalin and Dexedrine, which also release dopamine in the brain. So first of all, a lot of mothers who smoke already have an addicted problem. Number one, if they have an addictive problem, it means that they've had stressed lives. And that means that, and the smoking is one way of soothing stress. So your question is very apt. Is it the effect of the tobacco, or is it the effect of the stress? Well, the answer is both. You know, smoking will have deleterious effects on the developing system of the child, but so will the stresses that the mother is inadvertently trying to soothe through the cigarette habit. So it's a combination of both. And a British study showed that women who are abused by their partners, their children will have more likely to have ADHD during pregnancy. Their children will have more likely to have developmental conditions like ADD, for example. And when you look at the placenta at the time of birth, there's a higher level of the stress hormone cortisol. Now, that makes sense because when people are under stress, they release more cortisol. Now, cortisol has a major effect on brain development and in other ways as well. So that, you know, it all comes together. You can't isolate any single factor. But what you can say is that the more stressed the environment is for a child, the more likelihood addiction will somehow crop up. And that means that in our society, with the breakdown of family and extended family and village and all that, many of us grow up under stressed circumstances to one degree or another. Most stressed are the kids who are actually abused. And they're the ones who end up in the streets with injection, drug use problems, and intractable ones. But again, it's a continuum.
What about situations like in your book, you write about Vietnam and veterans there who were under stress?
Well, that's a typical example. Vietnam is a typical example because the study showed that after the war, when the GIs returned, 20% of them were addicted to heroin. 20%. Now, there's this general myth that drugs cause addiction. You do a drug, you get addicted, which is, of course, scientific nonsense. And as the Vietnam experience showed, because after a few years, only 5% of those, only 1% of the GIs were addicted. So 95% of these addicts amongst them got over their addiction fairly quickly. Now, if the drugs by themselves could induce the addiction, they all should have stayed addicts. And if drugs by themselves cause addiction, then you couldn't go to the hospital and get a morphine for pain. But you can give people morphine for pain for a long time if they need it. And once the pain is gone, they quite rapidly get off their morphine so that the drugs themselves don't cause the addiction. It's a susceptibility. Now, when you look at that 1% of the GIs who stayed addicted, they were the ones who came from troubled families. And for the rest, it was the stress of the war. So now, first of all, you have to notice that out of 100 GIs, 80 didn't become addicted at all. 20 did. And for them, and for most of them, it was the specific stress of the war plus a mild susceptibility. Well, once they got back stateside, with the stress of the war, of a meaningless and very dangerous and cruel war, had been lifted from the shoulders, the addiction burden was also lifted from the shoulders. The small minority that stayed addicted were the ones that were highly predisposed because of what had happened to them early in life.
So do you see in other societies beyond North America, then, the addiction rates are noticeably lower?
Well, I mean, a good case example is the experience of Aboriginal peoples in North America. Before the coming of what we like to call European civilization to North America, there were addictive substances here. That is to say, addictive substances that had addictive potential, such as tobacco, such as alcoholic spirits in some areas, and peyote. But there's absolutely no evidence or history of addiction on a mass scale at all, or even close to anything close to it. These substances were used in spiritual ways, in communal ways, under the guidance of elders and shamans. Now, if you look at the addiction rate amongst Aboriginal people in Canada, and I would guess in the United States as well, in our streets in the downtown east side, in our jails in Canada, for sure, you have a tremendous, disproportionately high ratio of Aboriginal people. But what happened to these people? They were dislocated from their homes. Their livelihood was denied to them. They were massacred. In Canada, at least, for generations, they were forced to send their children to these residential schools run by churches of all denominations, where they were sexually and physically and morally abused. And, of course, their natural ways of making a living were deprived from them, they were deprived of them, because of the land needs and claims of the settler population that displaced them. And they were forced into reservations, and their spiritual ways were invalidated, and now you have a huge addiction problem where in some native areas of Canada and reservations, you have an 80% addiction rate. And it's tragic, and the abuse is passed on from one generation to the next. And if you look at American statistics, the most likely to be sexually violated is a Native American woman, and 80% of the time by non-Native men. In Alaska, at least, that's true. Sarah Palin doesn't talk about that too much, but it happens to be a statistical fact. So then no wonder then that these people then, you know, find addictive substances to soothe their tremendous pain, because if you look at all the addictive substances, in one way or another, they're all painkillers. And so the central question in addiction, to my mind, is, and which as I say in my book, is not why the addiction, but why the pain.
That begs the question of then, how did you get people to get off their addiction?
Sure.
That would be by stopping the pain, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right. So when you look at the war on drugs, see, if you had a bunch of geniuses huddled in around a situation table in some room, they say to themselves, hey, we know that the scientific evidence is clear that the biggest driver of addictive behaviors is stress. How should we help the drug addicts in our country? Let's make war on them. Let's ostracize them. Let's impoverish them. Let's judge them mercilessly. Let's criminalize them. Let's throw them into jails where there's no help for them whatsoever. Overcrowded jails where they're treated harshly. And after that, let's throw them back onto the streets. That's the way to get rid of their addiction, for sure. I mean, who would come up with such a system? But that's the system we got, for the most part. Now, of course, given that what caused addiction was a lack of nurturing and support in the first place, the solution is to nurture and support people. And so approaches that meet people where they're at, even to the extent of allowing them to use their substances under, you know, nurturing supervision, wherever that's being tried, the results are great. You know, and in Seattle, there are places where people are, there's a low threshold alcohol, you know. I think the residence is called 1811. And people end up drinking less alcohol that way. And in Vancouver, we have the supervised injection site, where people are allowed to come and bring their substances and inject. We don't give them their substances. I would like to. The studies that where we do that, they show nothing but good results. But at least they're bringing their own substances. They inject under supervision. If they overdose, they get help. Lives have been saved. And people get clean needles and sterile swabs, so they're no longer using puddle water in the back alley to inject, but they're getting sterile water to inject with. There's less disease transmission, obviously. Hepatitis C, HIV, all kinds of other infective organisms are not passed on from one person to another. And people have the opportunity to receive some compassionate care, which is their first step towards some kind of rehabilitation. So that the real solution here is not more harsh and more punitive and restrictive measures, but actually embracing the addict at whichever level they happen to be at. Now, for some people, that might mean immediate abstinence. If that's where they're at, that's great. You just simply can't accept or expect that everybody will be at that level, and you have to bring them along stepwise. So there has to be a wide-ranging, stepwise, graded, compassionate, science-based, humane, medical and social treatment program, which we could do financially quite nicely if we didn't waste all this money on this retrograde and demonstrably, incontrovertibly worse than useless war on drugs.
How much does our society contribute to addictions from the standpoint of it being a consumer society? That, well, you know, we don't have citizens, we have consumers.
Well, culturally, look at the absurdity. We point our finger at the drug addict and we say, how can you be putting something toxic into yourself that you know is going to destroy you? Then we get into our SUVs and, you know, the kind of industries that we have that are destroying, because of our attachment to short-term pleasure and the consumer culture, we're literally destroying the earth. That's not controversial anymore, except maybe in the former White House and in Canada's current cabinet offices. But other than that, nobody with any credibility argues very much anymore that, you know, global climate change is not a problem for us that we're creating because of our consumerism. In other words, we have live in an addicted culture, because my definition of addiction, again, is any behavior with negative consequences that we continue to crave and relapse into despite those negative consequences. What do you call the consumer culture? It's a massively addictive culture. And, of course, advertising exploits people's natural susceptibilities and vulnerabilities. And so basically advertisement fundamentally says to you, soothe yourself with this particular product. This will make you happy. This will make you feel okay about yourself. Do this, be that, buy this, and you'll be okay for the first time in your life. And furthermore, without these things, you're inadequate. So without attainment, possession, you know. Although advertisement and the consumer culture can't by itself create addiction simply because of the messages it sends out, it powerfully hooks into people's insecurities and exacerbates them. And, of course, creates more social dislocation, which then feeds the addictive drive of large numbers of people. And I do talk about that issue in the book as well, just this particular dynamic of the social encouragement towards addiction.
Canadian physician Dr. Gabor Maté, expanding his focus at the end to our corporate-controlled consumer culture's addiction to gas-guzzling cars, burning every hydrocarbon we can possibly burn, and corporate growth, growth, growth. Despite the fact that in doing this, we are extremely close to destroying life on this planet. And many of the same folks who are profiting from this addiction of ours, who are encouraging us to deny that there is any problem with what we are doing, also are urging more and more war against the already abused people who are shooting up heroin in back alleyways, or smoking marijuana in the park. In a speech in Berkeley this November, Maté ends on the same point I began on. Here's another way of putting it. The war on drugs has totally failed to reach its stated goals. That is obvious to everyone. Don't waste your time patiently explaining to the president's drug czar that the drug policies of the past 50 years are not working, and will never work, and are hurting the citizens more than helping them. The drug czar is not a stupid person. He knows that everything you're saying is true. If you're trying to inform him, what you haven't figured out yet is that the stated goals of the drug war are not the real goals. But let's let Maté have the final say here, including a final note of optimism.
And there's no war on drugs, because you can't war on inanimate objects. There's only a war on drug addicts. which means that we're warring on the most abused and vulnerable segments of the population. And we could argue left and right what a failure the war on drugs has been, because you can see that it's not working. But you know what? I have a different point of view. If decade after decade after decade, the stated intentions of our policies are not being realized, in fact, the very opposite is happening, then is it really a failure? Or maybe is it serving some purpose? Maybe it's serving the purpose of maintaining the rationale, the raison d'etre, of law enforcement and a repressive apparatus that can be used against the people when the need arises. Maybe it has the function of demonizing a certain section of the population and increasing the fear in the rest of the population that justifies more repression. Maybe it has the function of keeping a whole legal apparatus going. Maybe it has the function of making a lot of money for a lot of people. Maybe it has the function of fueling the privatized incarceration industry. So maybe, after all, it's not such a failure at all. And from that perspective, was the Vietnam War a failure? No, it wasn't. It was lost militarily, but the end result was that the U.S. still gets to control the economies of Southeast Asia. Is the Iraq War a failure? Well, it is for the people who died there, for the 500,000 Iraqis or a million whose lives are lost. But it's not a failure for the American oil companies. So that every war, we have to be careful before we call them failures. Somebody wins. The somebody who wins are the same people who are destroying neighborhoods and communities. It's the same system that undermines human health, that undermines human dignity, that undermines human connection, that really makes life less tolerable on our planet. Now, we don't have to agree on what the solutions might be, and that's okay. What we do agree on is the importance of speaking the truth. What we do agree on is the importance of people getting together and struggling in a healthy way for a different life. Because if it's the loss of control and the isolation and the suppression of self-expression that are the greatest causes of stress, then surely one answer to the stress of this culture is to get together and to express ourselves and not to be silent and to connect with other human beings. Or as Joe Hill said, don't mourn, organize. Thank you very much.
Dr. Gabor Maté, nicely putting the drug problem, so-called, into a broader social, economic, and political context. New World Notes is not endorsing drug use of any kind, but drug use and drug addiction are results of some very serious social and economic problems. Problems that the ruling 1% would prefer that we not think about, let alone work to solve. That's not in their interest. So that's what we need to be working on. Many thanks to Mike McCormick and to Mind Over Matters for the fine interview, and to the National Radio Project, producers of Making Contact, for Maté's talk in Berkeley. You'll find links to the originals on our drug-free and only mildly addictive website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. Don't mourn, organize, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.